we had decided on the VPSO model in a time of limited financial means. If we spend that money effectively, there's no reason why we could not even use the same amount of money to get more safety results.
A state lawmaker calls for an audit of the Village Public Safety Officer Program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after a decade in lockdown, the state releases secret oil exploration data.
I think we might have overdone the secrecy at times, but I didn't wear handcuffs, but we indeed did not send them in with just anybody.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A state lawmaker wants the Village Public Safety Officer Program audited. He's concerned that the program isn't spending money efficiently. While lawmakers weigh whether to proceed, program supporters say it plays an important public safety role in villages. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Representative Dan Sadler says he wants more information on why many positions in the state-funded VPSO program are unfilled. The Eagle River Republican also is concerned about the share of program spending that goes into indirect costs, like housing for officers. That's why he's asked for a legislative audit.
I thought it was important to get some better answers to find out how we could find some efficiencies and savings and make our public safety dollars go farther in rural Alaska.
The VPSO program has seen a decrease in funding, along with the rest of state government, in the last 3 years. The number of program officers has also dropped from 92 in July 2014 to 53 this January. Much of the drop has been from an inability or failure to fill vacant positions. Only two-thirds of the 78 budgeted VPSO positions are filled.
We have heard information of some folks who had taken the VPSO training at some cost to the state and declined to work as VPSOs and turned around and worked for private contractors or other employers.
Since the program was started in 1979, VPSOs have worked for nonprofit Alaska Native organizations. They're often the first responders to emergencies and have increasingly focused on law enforcement. Jason Wilson oversees the work of six VPSOs in Southeast Alaska as the public safety manager for the Central Council for Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. He says they play an essential role.
They do a lot more than just law enforcement, but they're highly needed in our communities. With the budget cuts to state troopers, troopers are going out to our smaller communities a lot less often. So it's imperative that we have our VPSOs in our communities.
Wilson says the vacancies are primarily from a widespread decline in applications for law enforcement jobs.
We used to have people kind of waiting for positions to become available, and over probably the last 2 or 3 years, it's been extremely challenging. You know, the view on law enforcement in general has changed, maybe not so favorable, and, you know, it's not a job that people are looking to do.
Captain Andrew Merrill is the Alaska State Troopers VPSO program commander. He notes that VPSO training has increased from 10 to 15 weeks in recent years to prepare officers to carry firearms. This has also increased trainees' job opportunities, qualifying them for a wider range of jobs.
VPSOs work hand in hand with troopers in the field, and so, you know, having personal experience in the Fairbanks region and in the Bethel region as well as the Nome region working with VPSOs, those are an integral part of public safety throughout the state.
Sadler is looking for an outside perspective on the program. Sadler requested the audit through the legislature's Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. The committee could decide whether to order an audit at its next meeting, which is expected to be in early November. But the audit could start as late as 18 months from now, because the audit staff has several other audits to complete first. In addition to determining whether VPSO grants have been administered in a fiscally prudent manner, Sadler also is asking the auditors to evaluate the program's effectiveness, and if VPSOs could be funded with federal grants.
There is a real need for public safety in rural Alaska. We have decided on the VPSO model, and I think that if in a time of limited financial means, if we spend that money effectively, there's no reason why we could not even use the same amount of money to get more safety results.
Representative Scott Kawasaki says he'd like to address some of Sadler's points before an audit is done. Kawasaki, a Fairbanks Democrat, chairs the House subcommittee that oversees the public safety budget.
I think that a lot of the questions that Representative Sadler has asked are very important questions. I think a lot of the questions are from an urban lawmaker that may not understand how it's different in rural Alaska when it comes to the administration of justice.
Kawasaki says the subcommittee will seek more information on the VPSO program ahead of the annual budget process in the spring. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska's Oil and Gas Division is releasing valuable oil exploration data from leases on the North Slope and Cook Inlet. As part of a tax program created in 2003, companies could claim a credit in exchange for turning over seismic information and exploratory well data. The state agreed to hold onto the data for 10 years. Now they're going public with it for a fee. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
Somewhere in Anchorage, the state is hiding four giant suitcases of top-secret pictures of the ground. Seriously. The Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Mark Wiggin, says they weigh about 150 pounds apiece.
They're about a foot and a half wide by a foot and a half high by 8 inches deep. And in there are stacked these blocks, these 7 to 8 terabyte per block. Basically a floppy drive.
Add them all up, and those drives hold about 300 terabytes of valuable information from seismic testing and exploratory wells, essentially a map of what lies beneath the surface in one corner of Alaska. It's just one of the data sets the state has slowly been collecting from oil and gas companies since 2003. And that's when it launched a tax credit program that required companies to turn over that data if they wanted to redeem the credit. So far, there are at least 50 of these data sets stretching all the way from the North Slope to Cook Inlet. The information is key to developing theories about geological formations, theories like where oil might be located. And they are really expensive to produce. Companies spend millions buying leases, transporting equipment to explore and drill, hiring specialized imaging companies to scour remote fields, hoping to strike it big. Naturally, that data is highly secretive. If you're ConocoPhillips or Armstrong and you drill a promising new well, you don't want every company in the world knowing what you've found right when you've found it. So it's the state's responsibility to protect that data when companies turn it over to them.
Maybe I watch too many James Bond movies, but I'm picturing when you say these Pelican cases with like 300 terabytes of data on them. Is this like a thing where someone shows up at your office with like three briefcases of data handcuffed to their arm and hands it over to the state?
Well, we have it secured.
Okay, so they don't deliver it in armored trucks or anything. But Wiggin says it's not that far off base. For years, when companies wanted to bring in well log data from the field, they had to fly them from these far-flung places back into Anchorage. Wiggins knows because it was his job when he worked for a company as a test engineer.
In essence, I would bring it in, and you'd basically nearly have it handcuffed to you as you brought it into town. I think we might have overdone the secrecy at times, but I didn't wear handcuffs, but we indeed did not send them in with just anybody.
Under this program, the state released its first two data sets in 2016. It included a 3D seismic survey from the North Slope that covered a huge chunk of ground near Prudhoe Bay, and the state saw a burst of activity, requests from university researchers, companies, and contractors. And even getting that data is still vaguely super spy-ish. Steve Masterman is an acting deputy commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources.
What we have told people that we need to have them do is to have somebody bring by or mail in a brand new hard drive, still in the wrapper, never been touched to a computer, so we know that it's clean, and we will load on the data and send it back to them.
Wiggin says there's already a company using that data to decide where it's going to drill.
We released it, and they are working diligently to drill a well based on that seismic data this coming winter.
Wiggin says that's a best-case scenario for the state.
they were able to access inexpensive seismic data and develop prospects of their own that would lead to exploration and surely, hopefully, development.
This fall, the state plans to release a second batch of data. Some of it is seismic data that covers areas of the National Petroleum Reserve. Some of it is well data from a Cook Inlet field that Blue Crest Energy is currently exploring. And along with that second release of data is a new set of fees. They'll charge $300 a square mile for 3D seismic data, plus another $1.50 per gigabyte. That means that getting copies of the data in those four suitcases could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, though Masterman says there is an option to cherry-pick parts of a data set to avoid running up costs. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
In the interest of full disclosure, Mark Wiggin is on the board for Alaska Public Media. Even though the primary election is still 11 months away, the Alaska governor's race was shaken up today with announcements from two Republicans from Wasilla. State Senator Mike Dunleavy announced he is suspending his gubernatorial campaign to deal with an unspecified health issue. At the same time, former State Senate President Charlie Huggins filed paperwork with the Alaska Public Offices Commission to run for governor. Other announced Republicans are Jacob Seth Kern and Michael Sheldon. Kirk Wilson has also filed paperwork but didn't list a party. Incumbent Governor Bill Walker also has announced he's seeking a second term. As an independent, he wouldn't have a primary challenge. So far, there are no announced Democrats in the race. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the owner of an energy startup in Anchorage hears a financial siren song.
Piper, I just want to bring $200 million of clean energy capital to Alaska. Can you help me do that?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
Police in Anchorage say they're confident there's no threat to public safety after a suspect was arrested in a shooting at a precious metal shop that left three people dead. Anchorage Police spokesman MJ Tim says investigators are sorting out the suspect's relationship with the victims and the possible motive for the shooting on Tuesday. Just before 10 a.m., police received calls of a shooting at the Bullion Brothers, a shop that buys and sells gold, silver, and coins. They found a man dead in the doorway, another in an office, and a third man mortally wounded. Acting on a tip, police stopped a car and took the driver into custody. In recent years, communities across rural Alaska have pushed to add renewable energy and reduce the use of expensive diesel to power their communities. The majority of those projects have been funded with state and federal grants. But as the state budget has contracted, those grants have dried up. Now, a startup company in Anchorage wants to take a new approach, connecting private investors to the state's remote villages. Rachel Waldholtz with Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Piper Foster Wilder moved to Alaska a couple years ago after working on renewable energy in the lower 48. And she saw a gap between the way renewables are viewed down south and the way they're viewed up here. In the lower 48,
there was nothing fringy, alternative, or outside of the mainstream about renewable energy, that this is the business of suit and tie wearing people who are making a lot of money doing it.
But up here,
that argument is still being made in Alaska.
Foster Wilder wants to bring some of that suit and tie attitude to the state with her startup company, 60 Hertz Microgrids. In the past, the state might have covered the cost of a wind turbine or solar array for a rural community, perhaps with a grant from the Renewable Energy Fund. With shrinking state budgets, that's generally no longer an option. And it can be hard for communities to qualify for affordable loans for renewable projects. So Foster Wilder says it's time to try a different model. She says investors are looking for renewable energy projects to put their money in because of special tax incentives for renewables.
This was the light bulb that went off for me a year ago. I was meeting with an investor and he said, "Piper, I just want to bring $200 million of clean energy capital to Alaska. Can you help me do that?"
So she thought, okay. Let's connect that money to villages. Her goal is to aggregate several community projects, creating a big enough pool that it's attractive to investors, and so the projects can take advantage of economies of scale.
Our goal is to simplify the process, to be a bridge between money and need. So who are investors that want to take advantage of the incentives of investing in renewable energy? And who are the people that need that capital, that need the money, so that they can pay for this infrastructure in a fair way?
Will it work? So far, it's untested. 60 Hertz is running a contest looking for communities to partner with. It hopes to find a partner interested in testing the model this fall. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Some new information is available about an August commuter flight accident in the Juneau area. The Haines-based pilot made an emergency water landing, and he, along with four passengers, swam safely to shore. As KHNS's Abby Collins reports, an investigation into the accident takes a close look at the aircraft's fuel sources.
Early in the morning on August 14th, an Alaska Seaplanes flight left the Haines Airport and stopped in Skagway to pick up passengers before heading to Juneau. But about 3 miles from the Juneau Airport, the pilot made an emergency water landing. Haines resident Luck Dunbar was on the plane. He spoke to KHNS the day of the accident.
Well, there you are. You're sitting there thinking, well, this is it. This is it. Here we go.
All four passengers and the pilot swam to shore on Coghlan Island uninjured. Haines resident Josh Poirier was the pilot. According to a preliminary report from the National Transportation Safety Board, Poirier said he measured the fuel tank levels before taking off. He estimated 26 gallons in the right tank and 11 in the left. He used the right fuel tank during the flight. Noreen Price is leading the NTSB's investigation into the accident. She says that should have been enough fuel to complete the trip. But as he was approaching the Juneau Airport, Poirier told the NTSB the engine fuel flow reduced to almost zero and lost all power. Poirier said he switched to the left fuel tank, but engine power was not restored. He ditched the plane in the water near Coghlan Island and was able to keep the plane upright as he and the passengers exited the aircraft and swam to shore. Carl Ramseth is the general manager of Alaska Seaplanes. In an email, he says, "I can't say enough about the pilot Josh Poirier, whose actions contributed to the positive outcome the morning of August 14th. The aircraft sunk into the ocean, but was later recovered. Price says the ability to recover the aircraft is significant for the investigation.
When there is an accident, we like to go to the scene of the accident so we could see what the wreckage looks like at the scene itself and examine it very closely. While we couldn't go down to the bottom of the ocean to look at the plane, the ability to pull it up allows us to at least look at the flight controls, the fuel systems, the air systems, the engine itself."
An inspection of the plane was conducted under the supervision of the NTSB by a Federal Aviation Administration safety inspector, Cessna and Continental Air Safety Investigators, and a representative from Alaska Seaplanes. According to the report, 2 gallons of fuel were recovered from the right tank and 11 from the left. An owner's manual on the plane said once the fuel level gets down to 2 gallons, it's unusable. Price says there's still a lot of uncertainty about the cause of the accident.
"At this time, we don't know if there was anything mechanical wrong with the plane. In my preliminary report, I mentioned there was wrinkling with the fuel bladders, and that is an abnormal condition for an airplane. So we don't know what caused the wrinkling in the fuel bladders. It may have contributed to the accident. At this time, we really don't know."
Price says the NTSB is not yet finished with the preliminary phase of the investigation. A factual report with a probable cause should be completed within 1 to 2 years. Ramseth says Seaplanes will continue to work with the NTSB while it determines the cause of the accident. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A proposed prohibition on intoxication in public places has failed in the Alaska gold rush town of Nome, which has long grappled with hard drinking. Officials say the proposed local law fell short of the necessary city council votes on Monday to proceed to a second vote. The measure would have banned intoxication in public rights of way, including the city's front street, where street drinkers can be seen staggering along or passed out near tourist shops. The measure included no penalty for violators, but City Manager Tom Morin has said it could be amended to add a fine if it passed. The measure prompted a tepid response from officials and mostly opposition from locals who said it would unfairly target people struggling with alcoholism while failing to address underlying causes. Each September, Arctic sea ice extent reaches its annual low before gradual refreezing begins. It's a climate change marker scientists watch closely. According to climatologist Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment, this year's Arctic sea ice retreat won't break the record set in 2012, but it's not too far behind. Bretschneider says it's strikingly low compared to two decades ago. He tells editor Annie Feit the ice extent is shaping up to be around the seventh lowest on record.
So based on the daily data from the National Snow and Ice Data Center, it appears that we possibly have reached that annual minimum. They have to make that official call. But if it hasn't already occurred in the last day or so, we're almost, you know, we're within just 1 or 2 days, and the values isn't going to change all that much.
But just last month, things look like they might end up much different, right?
So, yeah, if you looked at the trend line of where we were heading all the way running up through, say, mid-August, we were running just slightly ahead of the lowest sea ice extent on record. So it looked like we were going to be kind of neck and neck for possibly a new seasonal minimum. But what ended up happening is the atmospheric conditions that promote melting or lack of melting in the high Arctic kind of tilted toward protecting that ice for the last month or so. And so all the things that kind of could have gone wrong and sent us into a new record low, they didn't happen. And that ice kind of held on better than we normally would have expected. So instead of being the lowest on record or the second lowest, we're probably going to end up in somewhere in the sixth to eighth lowest daily low sea ice extent on record.
But even the sixth or eighth lowest on record is pretty low, right?
Right. So if you look at the lowest values, I mean, all of the, say, the 11 lowest values have occurred in the last 11 years. So it's a different regime than we had decades ago, where the September sea ice minimum was in the 6.5 to 7.5 million square kilometer range. Now it's consistently lower than, say, 4.5 to 5 million every year, where our sea ice minimum is that much different than it was just as little as two decades ago.
And why do scientists watch the Arctic sea ice extent so closely?
Well, it really is a driver of a lot of the globe's climate. It really helps the presence of the ice acts as a control on the temperature of the entire planet. So when there's ice on the water, it acts like a mirror for solar energy. As soon as the sun's energy hits that, bounces back off into space, it's kind of like it never occurred. But when you take away that ice, you make it so that the exact opposite occurs. That water absorbs that solar energy, and then it heats up. And that changes a lot of things as far as atmospheric patterns, ocean currents, you know, the position of the jet stream, just many, many cascading effects. So when you remove that ice, the kind of the whole globe's weather patterns, atmospheric patterns, can shift into a new regime.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Could a cross-boundary mining battle lead to a trade war with Canada? A Southeast Alaska tribal organization is using that possibility to push federal officials into providing stronger protections for regional fisheries. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
A coalition of 16 Southeast tribal governments has filed paperwork that could lead to trade sanctions against British Columbia, which borders the region. Frederick Olson Jr. is chairman of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. He says about half of the region's tribal governments have signed a petition to the Federal Department of the Interior.
The goal is to get federal involvement in our transboundary mining issue. And so we are getting some more of our member tribes to sign on.
What's called a Pelley petition is allowed under a provision of the Federal Fishermen's Protective Act. Guy Archibald is staff scientist for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, which also opposes transboundary mining.
If another country is found to be violating the tenets of the Fishermen's Act, the other country can institute trade sanctions against that country.
A number of advocacy groups and local governments are concerned about mines on or near British Columbia rivers that flow through southeast. They say silt, minerals, and acidic water from the mines will damage fish stocks on both sides of the border. British Columbia's mineral extraction industry says it develops and operates its mines safely with limited environmental impacts. Archibald says trade sanctions are not the petition's real goal. Instead, the groups want federal officials to put their concerns before the International Joint Commission. That panel moderates disputes involving U.S.-Canada boundary waters.
Now, nobody really wants to start a trade war with British Columbia. Basically, what they're saying is that if neither country wants to refer this matter to the International Joint Commission, we as people of this side have other options, and that maybe an International Joint Commission would be a less onerous of the two options.
Interior Department officials did not immediately respond to inquiries about the petition. Archibald says they've told petitioners they're looking into it, but that's all. Earlier efforts trying to get the State Department to involve the Joint Commission were unsuccessful. The Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission is the new name for the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group. Olson, the chairman and a Kasan resident, says the new name addresses the wider scope of the group's work. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Rachel Waldholz and Annie Feit in Anchorage, and Abby Collins in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.